It's the Lifetime Body Podcast, where science meets common sense and where we help you make your body last a lifetime. Join physical therapist, author, and human performance expert John Zombro and inquisitive life-optimizing co-host PK the Incomparable as we explore the secrets of food, movement, sleep, ergonomics, and awareness in the pursuit of ultimate wellness. In each and every show, you'll learn how to look, feel, and perform your best so that you can live your longest, healthiest, and happiest life. This is the Lifetime Body Podcast, and I am your host, John Zombro, joined with my colleague, PK. Good morning, PK.
Good morning, Jay-Z. How you doing?
Oh, doing great, and really looking forward to sharing with the listeners today's topics, because these are things that just come up all the time.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is we're going to just talk briefly about some key items or some pearls of wellness wisdom, if you will, about movement, food, and sleep. And specifically today, we'll look at how those things are commonly occurring and where they fit into the big five components of the lifetime body. We'll also take a look at, well, what's the single most effective or bang for your buck fitness exercise you can do if you only could pick one. We'll talk a little bit about how do we coordinate training with eating and some of the nuances around that topic. And also just look at a few pieces of low-hanging fruit or game changers to do to the bedroom to make it more sleep-friendly.
Absolutely. I'm excited. And this kind of came together, focusing on the big three this morning. How?
Well, as you know, and I'm sure the listeners know that, the lifetime body is based around five components that help you to achieve ultimate wellness and make your body last a lifetime. And in any order, they're movement, food, sleep, ergonomics, and awareness. However, more people than not are really keyed into those first three items, movement, food, and sleep. And so there are many frequently asked questions or even recently asked questions from clients and listeners that we're going to touch on today.
All right. Love it.
Okay, so what you and I have been doing, just kind of supplementing, is we've been digging cold-induced thermogenesis. And, we live in Southwest Montana where it looks like winter is on the way. And we've got a hike and a dunk slated for tomorrow. And we're probably looking at air and water temps in the 40s, or in other words, 40 degree water and 40 degree air.
Yes, we are. I do think that we need to explain what cold induced thermogenesis is to the listeners for folks who may not know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So let's say, you do the popular cryo tanks these days, that type of therapy, you could do that, but simply plunging into some cold water and submersing the head and then staying in as long as, you can reasonably tolerate, it's known as a hormetic stressor, and it can upgrade our metabolism and improve immune function significantly. So that's sort of what we're doing it for. I don't think you and I have a lot of inflammation that we're trying to kill at this time, but definitely getting a really effervescent effect usually each week.
Yeah, and this may be one of the last weeks that we'll be able to do that out here in Montana before it gets too cold.
Yeah, we're not going to chip through the ice, that's for sure.
I'm excited for it.
Yeah, me too. And I think also, like we've talked about this a little bit on the show, but will in the future, there's cold exposure and, it's got some values, and certainly doing it year round is an option. But my instincts sort of guide me for more heat in the winter. And so, I think that's going to be sauna related one of these days. So, just cool things to look forward to that sort of supplement these other lifestyle factors that we're going to talk about.
Absolutely.
And sorry for cutting you off there. Back to the big three, though. These are all, food, movement, sleep, major components in the work that I do with my clients. And it's particularly present in the project books. So those science projects that turn into books on how to do things. I've got one out there, which is, all about how to train to extract an athletic accomplishment from yourself. And that was a couple years ago, me running under 60 seconds for 400 meters. had to use the best of science and training to get that to happen, but it's there. Also Project 9-10-17, and that's all about body composition and losing fat, gaining muscle. How does one do that? What are some of the really exciting tweaks that's available on Amazon? And then most recently, we've got Project Jacked, which is really that whole comprehensive metabolic reset, weight loss, health, and fitness program. And we're even going to have a show coming up with one of the participants who kind of reached out to me and said, you know, this was such a great thing, a life changer. I'd like to share that with your audience. And so we'll be doing that.
Absolutely. And so you've done these science projects, and so you've in varying ways, you've experimented with, concepts around the big three, and sort of the best in breed have kind of filtered up to the top then.
Yeah. And it's just, this is the world that I'm living in all the time. I think if you're a listener, you probably are as well. And this week I'm giving a presentation in support of health and fitness and wellness and longevity at our local library here in Belgrade, the Belgrade Public Library, from 6 to 7, and lifetime body refreshments or lifetime body approved refreshments are going to be served. And so if anyone is local and a listener wants to come out, again, that's at the Belgrade Library from 6 to 7. And we're going to talk about these topics, not quite the same way as in today's podcast, but definitely present some of the latest science, and also have hopefully some lively Q&A.
Absolutely. But today on the show, you'll be able to pluck a couple of those if you're listening, those pearls. And but if you go to the Belgrade Library, you'll still be able to get some additional, because you go into more detail.
Bam! That's all I can say.
Excellent. Well, let's get right into it. Starting with number one, movement.
Okay. This is the question. If I can only pick one exercise, what's the single best thing I can do to get the most out of my training?
John, is this a question that you get from clients or audience members out there?
All the time.
Okay. Well, you know, don't make us wait any longer. What is it?
Okay. Well, it's what I would call resistance training for the legs. And when we do that, you know, we're using the whole body, first of all, but lunges, step ups, or split squats. So that category is probably the best exercise that you can do if you're only going to do one exercise. Of course, we're going to tell you why.
Yeah, we'll keep it going. Don't keep me in suspense.
When we do those movements, we enhance our life capacities and our performance maximally because a lower extremity anti-gravity exercise done in a functional movement pattern, it works the full body, and it trains the body to be more durable in everything that we do.
Okay. So what do you mean by anti-gravity?
Oh, basically, you know, we're lifting our body weight and or additional resistance up and down against gravity, and, you know, our feet are planted on the floor. So that's a, you know, super basic thing that humans have done for 2.5 million years, and we do so many times every day, or at least should be able to do that.
Absolutely. And by focusing on the lower body, it uses the whole body because we're stabilizing, you know, we're using our core and our arms. How does that actually translate into a whole body?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of trickled up the chain there, and that's entirely true. How much we use the arms probably depends on, you know, if we're holding a weight or that sort of thing. But certainly the trunk and even up into the shoulder girdle gets trained in these movements, and also it really helps to reinforce optimal posture. So it's just such a great bang for your fitness buck.
Excellent. Well, how should we best go about doing it?
Well, you know, the question that gets asked usually is, well, why the staggered stance? So in other words, a lunge or a step up or a split squat has a staggered stance to some degree, you know, one foot's forward of the other, and it may even be slightly asymmetrical from that point as well. We use that position as humans a little bit more than we use the parallel position where feet are parallel, you know, like we do a standard squat. Now, there's nothing wrong with doing the squat, and we're going to talk about that in a second, but the staggered stance is really how we locomote, we step up and down on things, and it's actually a little more safe than doing, let's say, a loaded parallel squat.
Excellent. Okay, cool. And any other reason why you suggest these staggered stance versus, you know, maybe that traditional squat format?
Well, it's it's really an interesting thing. We use the staggered stance or 1 foot forward, 1 foot back. Again, it could be a little bit more asymmetric than that, a little more than we use a parallel foot placement in most of our life. And again, there's nothing wrong with doing a squat, with a standard position, but that's a little more challenging in terms of technique for the body. So the staggered stance is both a little more functional and a little more safe.
Excellent. Nice. So if someone's at home saying, all right, I want to incorporate this, you know, best exercise for movement, what would you recommend what's the road forward for them?
Well, the beauty of these movements is variety. There's so much variety available. You can step forward, you can step backward, you can step sideways, or any combination when doing lunges. You can hold that split stance and just simply go up and down with the back foot on the floor, and that's a split stance squat. Or you can put the rear foot up on a bench or chair behind you, and it becomes known as a Bulgarian split squat. You know, anytime you call something in weight training Bulgarian, it's got to be good.
Excellent.
Yeah. And also there's like some foot placement with that. Some people will, dorsiflex their foot and kind of prop their foot up on their toes on that bench behind them. Others will point their toes down or plantar flex perform that way. Either way can work. And the width of the stance that one steps out from the bench or chair, there's a little bit of room for variety in that as well. Although super close or super far is going to feel awkward. And so instinctively you'll know how to set that up. Also, stepping up is just a wonderful thing, and this can be very progressive. You can use a book, a brick, a box, a bench, a lot of B words there, and progress the height as we go along. And oftentimes I'll have a person exercise on a step in their stairway, and I always say, if you're going to train in the stairway, work out at the bottom of the stairway, not the top, obviously for safety.
Right.
And you can do things to add weight. Well, you can hold dumbbells. You can hold them at your sides. You can hold the dumbbells up at the shoulders, hold a medicine ball in front of the body, wear a weight vest or a backpack, put a barbell in either a front rack position for those who can do that or across the shoulders. Doesn't really matter, but eventually you can find a way to make these exercises as progressively challenging as they need to be. And then on top of that, we can layer in, what's the total volume that you're doing, sets and reps, what's the frequency each week? Are you using sets and reps to quantify versus time? So I'm going to do this for 30 seconds versus 10 repetitions. What's the speed of the movement? Are we training super slow, doing some isometric holds and maximizing time under tension? Are we training more for a pump, or even ballistically and athletically? Are we moving quickly and maybe even incorporating a jump component to the stepping and lunging? So it's wonderful ways to be creative and just get so much out of anti-gravity staggered stance movements.
John, I really what I'm liking about this is that I'm thinking of our last podcast when we were talking about the different types of movements with connecting them with cooking and food movements and strength training, and how perhaps it may be intimidating. The way that you just walked through that there's a lot of low-hanging fruit and ways to, start strength training in a way that has a high return on investment in ways that are like very achievable if you haven't done a lot of strength training before.
Yeah, absolutely. Make this thing, we call training, we call life easy and approachable. And you can scale this up or down. I mean, an absolute beginner who happens to be 80 years old can find a way to do this safely. And we can also make it so that an Olympian can train aggressively for his or her sport.
Absolutely. Well, and today's the legs day for me, so I'm even more fired up.
And you got a lot of leg power, sir.
You stop it. What are we talking about next? What is the what's number two on the big three?
Well, a great segue, because you look at training. We were just talking about a movement, an exercise there. But so often folks will ask, well, how do you optimally coordinate your eating with your training?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, doesn't that go hand in hand once you start thinking about what your training looks like, nutrition and food and what you're eating kind of is a close second?
Yeah. And, you know, this is one of those amazing topics where you can make it as complicated or as simple as you want. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, doing any of that. So, you know, whatever works best for you. We're always about this whole, you know, look, feel, and perform your best. But since we're talking about eating and food, I would like to tell everyone about today's episode sponsor, which is Thrive Market.
Go on. Let us know.
Yeah, well, Thrive Market, as you know, they are an online wholesaler of organic foods, personal care products, and you know, over 5,000 items that are, you know, gluten-free and environmentally appropriate and sustainable, and that's a long list. But Thrive sells these products to consumers at 25 to 50% off retail.
All right.
So then you say, oh gosh, well, I'd like to take advantage of that deal for, you know, whether it's, you know, oil or nuts or soaps, et cetera. Well, how do I do that? Well, you go to the Lifetime Body Shop page and you click on the banner, and here's where things get really zesty. Not only does Thrive every time sell everything for 25 to 50% off, but clicking through that banner gives you an additional 25% off your first order. It gives you a 30-day free trial, and your order, if it's over $50, ships for free. So it's a win times Avogadro's number.
Absolutely. And this is something where if, you know, you're running to your local supermarket and or maybe you have something that a product that you just can't get readily wherever you're at, today's the day to give Thrive Market a shot, because not only are you getting you know, a discount all the time. Today, it's like a discount, I guess, multiply.
Yeah. And so you're going to save yourself time, energy, and money. So instead of, you know, going driving to the store and doing all that, you can, you know, do a few lunges and a few split stance squats. And then the delivery is going to show up at your door. It's shipping for free in recycled and recyclable materials. And there's nothing but awesomeness surrounding the whole Thrive experience. I love their name, by the way. But yeah, I just want to say, hey, you know, thanks to Thrive for sponsoring the show. We really appreciate that. And also, if you're a listener, by all means, take advantage of this deal, because it's great, and we wouldn't endorse it if it wasn't.
Absolutely. I'm going to get on there today and get some bone broth. With the colder weather, that's on my shopping list.
Excellent. And I think I've got a little bit in the fridge that I just made, but I'm running low. So our next order might include some of that as well.
Nice. Well, thanks to Thrive Market. And let's get into sort of what we want to talk about around food is number two of the big three.
Yeah. So first of all, let's talk about fasted versus fed training. And so what that means, it's fairly obvious, but fasted training means, you know, we haven't eaten for several hours before a workout. Fed training might, you know, be the opposite, where we strategically try to consume, you know, a pre-workout feeding in hopes that that's going to support or maximize performance in the workout.
Excellent. Well, I think that just when you mention this topic off the top of my head, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, maybe bad science or maybe preconceived notions about there. I mean, you know, it's the spaghetti dinner before the soccer game pops into my mind. I don't think that's accurate. So I'm excited to hear you lay this out for us.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, we readily recognize that this is a really individual topic, you know, and everyone's probably going to have to look back on their experiences and say, gosh, you know, I noticed this worked well for me, this didn't. And then I would encourage continued experimentation, because you know, we've got some newer science that we can test on ourselves and figure out what your own success recipe, if you will, looks like. But you know, fasted training, really, you know, my recommendation to most people is it really works well for your cardio. You know, generally speaking, you know, that's low intensity. You know, we talked about the crock pot last week, and being in a fasted state just gets you that much quicker into fat burning, you know, fat burning for fuel, which is metabolically really well set up for this low, slow cardio mojo. So I usually recommend doing, you know, almost all cardio in a fasted state. And that's always dependent upon the person being relatively fat adapted or metabolically fat adapted going into that.
Right. So you're fat adapted. So what is, you know, what would sort of like you, an example of you doing, practicing this, you know, doing a fasted workout?
Yeah. So whether it's a cardiovascular or aerobic training workout, or even, you know, most of the, you know, resistance training or high intensity work that I'm going to do, if I'm not really serious about putting up numbers, you know, hitting markers, you know, it just feels more comfortable to me to do my training without a gut bomb, you know, a 9-bean burrito or something like that. I don't enjoy training with much in my stomach. Now, being fat adapted, the beauty of that is you don't have, you know, let's say food in the system spiking insulin, which triggers fat storage, not fat burning. So that workout does become a little bit more efficient at using fat for fuel. And if obviously if burning fat or even losing weight's a goal, it's better to do. Conversely, though, if a person's doing an explosive workout, that anaerobic glycolytic stuff, you know, almost like a CrossFit workout or, you know, anything along those lines, they may want to experiment, because I found personally that if I'm going to do that kind of training and I'm actually serious about, you know, trying to, you know, reach high performance, a pre-workout feeding helps me a bit. And what I'll do, and a lot of my clients will do, you know, about 90 minutes out, maybe, you know, make up some type of a smoothie that, you know, that's working for them and have that as a pre-workout feeding. But that's about the only distinction or difference I would make. I would say most of the time training does just fine in a fasted state, but feeding when something's going to be really intense and really important can have a place.
All right, then. Excellent. Any other sort of, you know, what are some other considerations when we're talking about fasted versus fed training?
Well, this is an evolving area of research, and it's really fascinating. But I would just say it's a great idea to experiment and experiment with, well, how do you feel? How do you feel before, during, and after with feeding versus fasting? And what was your performance? And I think you'll get the answer. So not a hard line here, but just, you know, encouraging people to experiment. And that also leads to kind of like the next topic in this, you know, training and eating combo, which is the demands that training puts upon our bodies for micronutrients, macronutrients, and calories.
Okay, carry on.
So it's really interesting, because the more explosive work we do, you know, that tends to be what we call glycolytic. In other words, we have to burn some stored sugar. You know, there's muscle glycogen and liver glycogen that our bodies store for that purpose. It's kind of like an emergency high octane fuel. We'll deplete that, and it resynthesizes even if you eat a very low carbohydrate diet. But if a person is doing high amounts and high frequency of high intensity exercise, they're probably going to notice that it stimulates carb cravings. And this is how the body's wired. It knows, hey, I've got to do this thing again. We depleted the emergency stores of nitrous oxide. And so there'll be that kind of thing happening. And so I've kind of experimented with this a lot myself. And, you know, if I just do recovery or mobility training, especially now that I've been for several years in this fat adaptive state, you know, I'll train in the late afternoon and then my usual dinner at some point later in the evening. The next day I wake up, I'm not hungry. You know, I didn't really deplete anything to any great degree. And I usually don't start thinking about food till lunch. But if I did this high intensity exercise, you know, hunger comes on, you know, pretty early, by about 9 in the morning. And I don't refuse that. I'm going to eat. And I'm craving a little more carbohydrate. So I might have some root vegetables or fruit in that feeding. And it seems to answer that need quite well. Conversely, if I'm doing heavy strength training, it's been a couple months since I've been doing that, but I'll have those same cravings around, you know, 9 or 10 in the morning, but it's protein that I want. And, you know, whether that's eggs or meat or whatever. And I think that's the body's signal, that inner signal is, gosh, you know, we're undergoing muscle protein synthesis. You've created this stimulus to break down and build muscle. And now you got to give us the building blocks to do it. So it's really cool if you can tune into that. And I listen and feed to that signal. But I think, you know, we've had some success with a lot of our clients you know, helping them to recognize those inner messages.
Interesting. That is fascinating. So, Wow, that is just interesting that based on the training, because you are listening for those signals, you can kind of tune into what the different types of foods that you're hungry for based on the training.
Yeah, and I say, you know, there will be people who will approach that very cognitively and say, well, I want to strategically plan to, you know, either consume ahead or consume after these things. And that's fine. That works. But I like to say, well, why don't you experiment, be a little more casual, and wait until you get the signal and listen to what it really is and see what satisfies you. A lot of times it's fascinating to see that.
Interesting. So what if someone is listening and they're like, all right, I'm, you know, the tops on my list is weight loss. And what are some things that I could think about connecting that to my food?
Sure. And that's, you know, overall in America, that's probably number one. You know, people want to lose weight and need to in a lot of cases. And so the key to this is probably threefold. One, get metabolically fat adapted. So you can skip breakfast. So, you know, I better explain that for a minute. So In other words, metabolically fat adapted, we've talked about this on the show before, but it basically means that, you know, you're eating a lower carb, usually slightly higher fat diet, and the body learns to use fat for fuel. It stops being dependent on carbohydrate, and it also then can switch readily between ingested dietary fat and stored body fat. So that's a painless thing to skip breakfast because you won't be hungry. You know, if you didn't overtrain the day before and you're fat adapted, you know, your body probably won't need to eat until midday. And that's that. What that does is that extends that fasting period where we are burning body fat and we're not exposing ourselves to insulin. You know, fantastic. Now, if a person is kind of new to all this and they're still, you know, functioning with a very carbohydrate dependent metabolism, you know, eating a lot of cereal and, you know, yogurt and fruit and that sort of thing every morning for breakfast, typically they wake up hungry and need to eat because they don't have the mechanism to access that stored body fat yet. So, you know, want to do that gently. So when I say, number one, skip breakfast. We might do that a few weeks in after a person changes some of their macro ratios first.
Got it. If they haven't, what do you recommend?
I would say go ahead and eat breakfast, but start transitioning it away from a higher carb and processed food, processed carb in particular, diet. And you know they'll get that metabolic machinery switched over so that it becomes very easy to just make your first feeding, which is breaking the fast anyway, closer to lunch.
Excellent. Very nice. Any other thoughts on weight loss?
Well, we've got three key points, and that was the first one. And the second one, another power lever, if you will. Make your first feeding, when you do eat, mostly fat and protein. The reason being, you know, fat really doesn't have a significant stimulus on our bodies to produce insulin. Protein will, but in most cases, not as much as carbohydrates. So by doing that, you know, first feeding, a little more fat and protein, not much carbohydrate, we still minimize insulin and get a little bit more extended fat burning into the day.
Got it. And so does this work? Like, let's say you haven't adapted your metabolism over to fat burning yet. And would it also work for the sort of the person who's just starting out to make the first feeding mostly fat and protein?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the way to do it, the way to start, and your body will thank you because, you know, all the hunger and the mood swings will just start to disappear rapidly.
Excellent. Well, what's number three?
Number three, and this is kind of a no-brainer. Again, I mean, all the stuff that we talk about it's basic science, but front load your day in terms of calories by eating more of your calories early than late. And there's some controversy in the literature around this topic. It does depend on how active a person is, et cetera, et cetera. But for the most part, if a person wants to lose weight, you know, we said, well, number one, let's get you fat adapted so you can skip breakfast. Number two, first feeding is not much carbs. Well, the third thing is, you know, if you're eating, and we don't overemphasize this in our world, but let's say you're eating 2,000 calories a day, and that's, let's say it's in two meals per day. Well, you know, if it's possible from a comfort perspective, maybe that first meal is 1,200, second meal is 800. That might give a little bit more impetus to safe, sustainable weight loss.
Excellent. Very interesting. Three key points there. Carry on, John.
Yeah. So I've only got two more things with food because, you know, it's a huge topic, but I just wanted to get these commonly asked, recently, frequently things out there. So the next one is intermittent fasting. You know, what's the big deal about intermittent fasting or time restricted feeding? You know, that's been popular for a couple of years in the media. And of course, in our world, we call it strategic dining intervals, or SDI, and that's not from the Reagan era, just in case anybody here knows about that. SDI, you know, so in other words, we are being strategic with when we eat for different reasons. It's also driven by instinct and appetite, but we're dining. We're not just eating, and we're not too mechanistic about it. We want to keep food as nourishment and celebration as well as everything else. And so that interval has been researched quite heavily in the last few years. And first of all, I would say this, let's never lose our common sense. Eat when hungry until satisfied, but not stuffed. Drink to thirst. This doesn't have to be complicated, and it can fall within that structure.
Yes. Yeah. So if someone's listening, they're like, what do you mean by this strategic dining interval? Practically, what does that mean?
Yeah, well, if we compress the time during the day that we eat into a shorter window, we get a lot of health benefits. First of all, you know, it does help us to burn more body fat because we're not exposed to as much insulin, and you know, that mechanism's very well documented. But the other thing is being in a, you know, mildly fasted as opposed to fed state upregulates some of our repair properties and metabolic properties. So there's things like apoptosis, which is a programmed death of senescent or damaged cells, and then a corresponding thing known as autophagy, where our body kind of cleans out that debris, and that only happens when we're not in a fed state. And so there's wonderful benefits there. And also, this is really ironic, the newest literature suggests that narrowing down the eating window can even help with muscle protein synthesis. We can actually build more muscle by not eating six meals a day over a 13-hour period. And that's contrary to what was taught, you know, a number of years, not too many ago, but indeed it's true.
Interesting. Interesting. So do you have different recommendations if someone's saying, I want to focus on weight loss versus my, you know, I've got an athletic performance I'm training for?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a great distinction because those are different goals. And we try not to metabolically multitask here. You know, let's do one thing at a time. So the sweet spot, again, for, let's say for most people, just in terms of general health and also for the athletic population, except for the extreme cases, is probably to eat in an 8 to 10 hour window. So in other words, you know, that could be something like 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. or 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., you know, that would be 10 hours. That's still getting some of those benefits, but it gives the opportunity to have, you know, several feedings, you know, comfort as far as, you know, stomach distension, all that, and get the nutrient levels in. So that's wonderful. And 9 hours has been shown to be a real sweet spot with regard to that muscle protein synthesis issue. But if we want to have all those health benefits plus get a little bit more in terms of weight loss, a 4 to 6 hour window is better. So that might be 10 to 2 or 10 to 4 or noon to 6, you know, whatever. And there are some people that just use the kind of like the 1-23 model. In other words, they eat one meal a day. And yes, that is true. But in my opinion, in the long term, I don't find that quite as sustainable. You know, sometimes there's hunger, there's social issues, but also getting enough calories, getting enough nutrients in a single feeding can be, for especially if a person's active, can be a challenge. So I like that 4 to 6 hour window, even for my weight loss people, because, you know, they can comfortably get two meals in and just feel better doing it.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you're using that 6 hour window and, you know, you can push off breakfast, have lunch and dinner just with a kind of in the normal flow of a day.
Yeah. And you feel great and you don't feel like you're missing out on anything, which is, that's kind of gets into that whole sustainability topic. If a diet or a lifestyle practice seems like a sacrifice, it's not going to last forever. And so, doing things that are built around common sense and science and joy. That's what it's all about.
Yes. Yes. And one thing as we're sort of wrapping up the food segment here is we're, you know, here definitely in Southwest Montana, but just, you know, the seasons are changing. And what do you recommend? Are there different, is there any considerations to think about as we kind of move from summer into fall and then we're looking at winter around the corner?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the last topic for sure. Circadian relationships, you know, circadian relationships to eating. So, you know, humans are diurnal animals, you know, we're programmed to function with the sun. And so our bodies kind of ramp up in the morning and then slow down in the evening. There's been fairly good research, and a lot of it's recent, that looks at, we have this kind of like metabolic clock that goes with the daylight hours, and our organs function best when, you know, that's when most of the things are happening. So eating when the sky is not totally dark, in other words, you know, when the sky is light, that's probably a good idea. And I've seen this with a lot of our clients here because, you know, we're fairly northerly in terms of latitude. So in the summer, we have really long days and, you know, people will eat dinner quite a bit later, but it's still light outside. And then in the winter, you know, it can get pretty short in December, January. And, you know, dinner might be it just instinctively happening a little earlier for most people. So the data is fairly convincing that eating late at night doesn't help us not only with weight loss goals and most times, but sleep quality and metabolic function. We do a little better if we can extend the fasting time by narrowing the feeding window and keeping it in the daylight.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we're moving on to number three of the big three today, and that's sleep. And really the question that I think that you've had the most are, what are the best ways to set up your bedroom for an awesome night's sleep?
Yeah, I just had a light bulb go off. Of course, you don't want too many light bulbs in your bedroom when you're trying to sleep. Ha ha. But, you know, we were just talking about, you know, the circadian rhythm. And so it's like, oh, you know, people ask questions that actually make sense. You know, listeners are awesome. Thank you for being so phenomenal, because, you know, this seems obvious to me. If we're talking about circadian function, we want to say, well, now what do we do to get a good night's sleep? And there's a lot of great references out there, but what I like to do is keep it in the simple things. How can you set your bedroom up for an awesome night's sleep?
Yeah. Well, John, how do we do that?
Keep it cool. You know, I mean, like, you're so cool naturally, you know, it's like, you know, the room's cool when you walk in, but we want our bedrooms to be about 62 to 66 degrees. The studies have really supported that temperature helps us to fall asleep and stay asleep more effectively than if it's warmer.
Really? And is that just because we have to get under the covers, or, you know, why is the cold more, you know, conducive to falling asleep and staying asleep?
You could look at it as almost like if you're heated up, you know, you're almost revved up. And so, you know, it's like being in a workout. You know, you don't want to be like that when you're trying to sleep. You're trying to sink into this dormancy, you know, or it's our mini hibernation every 24 hours beginning. And so that's why we want it to be cool. We also want it to be dark. And by dark, you know, pitch black is really the color that you're looking for when you're laying in the bed. And that could be accomplished with blackout curtains, eliminating, you know, night lights and chargers. And if you use a alarm clock or just a clock that's near the bed, you know, one idea would be just to get rid of it so that, you know, you can eventually condition yourself to wake up naturally. But in the modern world, that's not always a comfort for someone. So I would just say, you know, if you have your clock there, turn it away from your head, your eyes, you know, if it's on the nightstand, and also maybe cover it with something. It could be, you know, a washcloth or whatever, so that you're not aware of the light. Wonderful tips there to remove light. And there have been some studies, there's a little bit of controversy over that now, but that have shown that even very small lights on in the bedroom, even like a smoke detector, can disrupt sleep.
Really? Okay. Well, I mean, in the modern world with all of our devices and lights and that could be a challenge.
Yeah, and that's where we get to number three on this list is, and it's the pushback item for sure. It's just remove electronics, you know, get the devices out of the bedroom. And it's, you know, it's a tough one for people to hear, and they're going to want to fight and argue, and that's fine. But any electronic device does several things. You know, most of them are blue light emitting. So we're talking about phones, tablets, et cetera. Even when you use the screen filters and maybe the blue blocker glasses, there's still a little bit of blue light getting into the eyes, which basically mimics the rays of the sun, which trigger wake up. And so we don't want that at night. They also all emit EMF or, you know, electromagnetic frequencies, which can keep us awake, but also have been correlated to aging and some other, you know, inflammatory things. So we definitely don't want devices on us or near us when sleeping, and probably the rest of the day either. And here's the crazy one. A lot of good data supports distraction, and it's distraction due to the actual presence of the thing. Even if you've got, you know, your, let's say your phone's on airplane mode, you've turned off all your notifications and sounds. If it's there, your subconscious mind knows it's there. And so you're more likely to keep some thoughts active and maybe check it or any of those things, all of which take away from the quality of your sleep.
Interesting. Interesting. So there's a little pushback, or maybe many of us think this is a tough one, because I use my phone for my alarm clock and all this stuff that we've kind of like migrated to have in our daily life. How much is that electronic affecting the sleep? I mean, you know, not a number, but just how much of an impact is my phone by the side of the bed, you know, potentially damaging my sleep?
Well, this gets back to kind of our basic principles again. You know, it's that moderate consistency type of idea. So as we go through some of these lists, you know, sometimes we look at, you know, here's what all the things the literature says. You actually probably don't need to do all of them to hit your threshold for results. So there might be some people that, oh, if their room is cool and dark and, you know, maybe their phone is on airplane mode, okay. And if they're waking up feeling refreshed and invigorated and ready to crush, I was like, yeah, they probably got good sleep. And maybe they're even using a sleep tracker to quantify that. So, you know, I always try to be objective about these things. The data is strong that it can hurt, but, you know, if you're offsetting it by doing a lot of other things, maybe you can get away with it. Again, up to each person.
Got it. So a little experimentation there personally. And well, what else is on your list of, you know, this optimal, you know, night sleep setup?
Well, loose jammies, and whether that's a superhero style or not.
Nice. Star Wars style?
Yeah, whatever works. But the idea here is that constrictive clothing worn in bed, you know, kind of limits us to a small amount how much the body can relax. And also, there's some associative data that says, gosh, you know, bra sleeping in women decreases lymph flow and has been associated with higher risk of breast cancer. For dudes, you know, let's say that the dude that sleeps with the nanner hammock, you know, that there have been some studies that say, well, okay, now you have lower sperm count and lower testosterone, as well as, you know, the sleep issue. So again, pajamas should be fairly loose fitting and not necessarily a full mummy suit of down, because then what happens is the body heats up too much at night. And so we want to, you know, kind of go into that next thing is, as opposed to more clothing, you know, beyond your basic pajamas, just have more blankets, because then you have more adjustability.
Got it. Okay. What are some other things that, you know, if someone's making a list that you would put on there to think about?
Yeah, I'd throw three together. Some folks, let's say, have a window open and the breeze is blowing, and that's wonderful. And then other folks might live near a stream, and so they automatically have a kind of a white noise option. But for those who are having trouble falling asleep, they might consider a white noise app. Of course, what I would say is, you know, whatever device you're playing it on, you don't have it right near the bed. Have it, like, you know, away in the room. But, you know, those sounds of rain or streams can be very relaxing and have been shown to help a person fall asleep.
Got it. Okay.
earplugs also, you know, if you're in an urban situation and you got a lot of sirens and other things, any doesn't have to be expensive. The really inexpensive soft foam ones that you can get in, you know, multi-packs everywhere can work great for that. Plus, are comfortable to have in the ear all night. The face masks, you know, the black masks that cover the eyes, mm-hmm. that can be valuable if, again, let's say you're someplace where there's a bright street light outside that you can't, for some reason, can't eliminate the light coming in. Maybe you're in a hotel, or if, you know, if a person's a shift worker, day sleeper, you know, that's not so good for their health, but if that's what they have to do, the face mask can be very valuable. And then the last thing I would hit on this list today is to use side or back sleeping positions with a good pillow. Stomach sleeping, it can be valuable for some people for the lower back, but it kind of jacks your neck around to a point where long-term it's not the best. But if a person lays on the side, maybe with a good fitting pillow under the head and one between the knees or on their back, again, a good pillow at the head. Some people like a pillow under their knees that way. Great thing to do. Those are good positions that work.
Interesting. Well, excellent. John, I've got a random question for you because it's kind of crossed my transom several times in the last couple of weeks, but I keep seeing these ads for these weighted blankets. Are you familiar with this? What is this?
Well, yes and no. There's an evolving technology now you can get cooling pads, you know, for your side of the bed, so you could be cooler than your partner if you, sure. you wanted to have that. There's, you know, these grounding devices which can, kind of have a grounding or earth contact effect in the, you know, sheets or you know, there's all that. But the presence of heaviness, particularly, you know, if we're all listening right now, I'm at my standing desk, you know, some people might be in other positions, but if you just gently place your hand on your abdomen, your upper abdomen, lower chest, and just press lightly, what you're feeling is, you know, it's a comfort thing that probably goes back to our infancy and it's relaxing and calming. And that's kind of that whole idea that pressure there can stimulate the vagus nerve. That's our 10th cranial nerve, which really drives our parasympathetic nervous system. Oh, yeah. So if you're, you know, let's say you're just trying to fall asleep and you just lay a pillow on your abdomen. Again, you don't want an anvil on there, but that little bit of extra weight, it can give you that snug, secure feeling. And again, this may even go back to, you know, like prenatal, you know, the very beginnings of how we function. So I think that's what they're trying to get at.
John, I tell you, and we did not talk about that in advance, and you do not disappoint, my friend. So, so how would you tie this all together today?
Yeah, it's all basic, simple, and instinctive. These things that we're doing and these things that we talked about today with respect to food, movement, and sleep, they work like nothing else. You can't get these results from pills and procedures. You know, it's magic. It's wonderful because the secret, the answer to health and wellness is this.
I love it. I love it. It's really achievable. It's within your grasp. There's nothing that we talked about today that any person who's interested can't implement into their life, regardless of the circumstances.
Cheap or free and easy. And you know, we're designed to be healthy. That's actually in our genetic code. We just have to remove the obstacles. You know, this great modern world we live in has a lot of wonderful things, but sometimes it creates obstacles to wellness. And so just by plucking away a few things, the body just starts to just take off. And what a great experience that is.
Absolutely. Very good. And so, you know, if someone's thinking about putting some of this into play, you know, what would be your final sort of recommendations?
Yeah, well, you know, whether you're talking about health or performance capacity, it's created by moving, eating, and sleeping. So it's the theme of today's show. And fitness, in particular, it's the combination of training plus recovery. So what we do with eating and sleeping and optimizing stress and relationships, you know, many of the things we talked about today facilitates recovery. So the training takes, And it's there for all of us if you know how to put those simple keys in place. But you know, for a lot of people, they know parts of what they need, but maybe not all of it. So that's what I do. You know, if a person wants to say, "Hey, John, I want to hire you. I want to get a consult or a coaching package so that I can go further towards my best self." That's what I'm here for. And you know, you can simply go to the website and lifetimebody.com, click on services, and you know, everything's automatic. So love to engage with some folks if they need and want to go to the next level.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah. And just wrapping up, again, I'm just filled with appreciation for the chance to do this, to work with you, PK, and also the listeners. And I want to give a second shout out to Ruthie K, who not only left us some great comments last week on the website, but she also gave us a fantastic review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. She's receiving a complimentary consulting session for saying this about the show: "This podcast is filled with positive vibes and scientifically based information. I wait for each new episode to drop with great anticipation. This is a must for listeners who need encouragement to stay on track or get on track with their health." So Ruth, you are magnacular, and thank you so much for your kind words and for inspiring us to keep on keeping on.
I love it. And, you know, if you're listening, get over to, whatever Apple podcast, rate and review. And, you know, this might be you next week.
Over and out. Thank you for listening to the Lifetime Body Podcast. If you'd like more information on the Lifetime Body publications and services that can help you to achieve ultimate wellness and look, feel, and perform your best, check out the lifetimebody.com. And if you're digging this content, please leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to the show and share it with your friends and family. Until next time, this is the Lifetime Body, where science meets common sense and where we help you make your body last a lifetime.